Welcome to the Alliance Party After Dark, a podcast for the politically aware brought to you by the Alliance Party. The interview in this podcast was originally recorded on September 5, 2019. My name is Dan Schaefer, producer of the Alliance Party After Dark, and this is the final in a four-part series where our moderator, M. Lloyd Johnson, discusses some very important current topics with the national chair of the Alliance Party, Mr. Jim Rex. As we've mentioned in the previous podcasts in this series, Jim Rex has a solid background in politics. He co-founded and chaired the American Party of South Carolina, and he was the last Democrat to win a statewide election in South Carolina when elected as the 16th State Superintendent of Education in 2006. Jim earned a PhD in Curriculum and Instruction from the University of Toledo. He started his career as a high school English teacher and football coach, and over the course of his educational career, he became the Dean of Education at Winthrop University and at Coastal Carolina University, and later he served as President of Columbia College in South Carolina. So we had a lot of questions for Jim, which took about 2 hours to get through everything, so we broke everything up into four episodes of about a half hour each. You're listening to the fourth and final in this series. In previous installments in this series, we talked about a variety of topics, including unemployment, the economy, healthcare, immigration, terrorism, domestic gun violence, and racism. In this episode, we'll discuss, among other things, how the Alliance Party plans to break through the political barriers in the current political duopoly. So if you're driving your car, make sure you buckle up, keep your eyes on the road, and get ready for an informative ride as we get the straight scoop from a leader of one of America's fastest-growing political parties. And now, M. Lloyd Johnson continues our interview with Jim Rex.
Now, turning our attention to being the best, how do we return to being number one? And I'm going to switch gears here. How do we return to being number one in compulsory education? And by that, I mean your pre-college education. And this is an area you might want to say why you're a particular expert in as well.
Okay, well, my background is, first of all, let me just say, you know, I grew up in a very poor rural area in Ohio. And I'm the first person in my mother's family and the first person in my father's family to go to college. And none of my friends went to college because of the community I grew up in. And I didn't go to college when I graduated from high school. I worked construction, and then I worked in a couple of factories. And the factories, the monotony of the working in the factories convinced me I wanted to get an education. And I tell you that because I've been very lucky, and in many ways, I've realized the so-called American dream personally because, you know, I became not only educated, not only held a PhD, but became a college president from that kind of background, and then became a constitutional officer in the state of South Carolina when I was elected as Secretary of Education. And I served in that role for the full four-year term. So, you know, through education, through some access to opportunity, I've seen, you know, what this nation can do. And that's one reason I'm such a fierce advocate for universal public education, which was one of the great inventions of this country. By the way, I mentioned a minute ago that other countries wanted to emulate us. Well, one of the ways they have emulated us is in universal education. We were the first nation that said every kid should have access to education. You know, in most nations, certainly the European nations and almost all the others, it was a caste system. People of privilege or wealth had access to education and others did not. If anything, they maybe had an apprenticeship or a trade, but no real education. And so that ideal is something that other nations emulated, just like you did our democracy. And what's happened over the last 30 or 40 years is that they have outpaced us. They've taken our idea and done a better job with it than we have. And so we used to be number one in terms of learner outcomes, graduation rates, test scores in math, science, reading levels. Now we hover around 15, 20, sometimes 30 in the world. And some of it is that we're not doing as well with enough kids, but a lot of it is that the other nations have just outpaced us. They placed more of an emphasis on education because they realize that the real global economy is not an arms race. It's a mind race. It's having the population that's best educated and best trained. That's how you win in the international competition for global dominance. Certainly the Chinese are a great example of that. but also countries like Finland, some of the Scandinavian countries, Singapore, they always rank at or very near the top. The reason they, and this goes back to what we're talking about in terms of research, looking at gun laws, for example, and gun behavior. When you look at these other countries and why they're doing so well in education compared to us, especially in recent decades, is that they place an emphasis on education. They have very high expectations and standards, not just for their children, but also for their teachers. The teaching profession is a highly valued, prestigious profession in these countries. And so they get the best and the brightest to go into teaching. And they spend a good deal of money on education, and they make available a lot of technology, great schools, great teachers for all of their children, not just for the ones who live in affluent areas, which is unfortunately what happens all too often in America. So we can look at the countries that are excelling and beating us, and it's pretty obvious how and why they're doing it. We just have not had the equal commitment these other countries have to education and training. And let me just make one last pitch. Our teachers are our future makers in this country. It's a very valuable profession. We have a lot of public servants. I mentioned police officers a while ago, extremely important. But our teachers are also an extremely important group for us as a nation if we want to succeed in the future and if we want to be competitive. And we have an incredible teacher shortage in America right now. It's gotten increasingly worse over the last decade or so. It's getting worse by the day. We're importing foreign teachers because we cannot find enough domestic homegrown teachers, especially in math and science and these other areas. There are lots of reasons for it. The profession itself does not have the status that it once had. The working conditions in many of our schools are abysmal. Learning conditions are terrible for kids, but the teaching conditions are equally terrible for teachers. And they're just not supported. The other dynamic, which is a mixed bag, not too many years ago, women in America didn't have a lot of occupational choices. They could be a nurse, they could be a secretary, or they could be a teacher. And for generations, we attracted some really outstanding, bright, dedicated women to the teaching profession. And many of us in my age group benefited from that teaching force. Today, luckily for women, they have lots of other options, and most of them are more attractive than teaching. And so the teaching profession is not attracting the quality or the quantity of people that it once did, because women now have other options, and it is still a female-dominated profession because of low pay and low status. So we've got to wake up as a nation. The battle, the internal competition is not going to be decided by how many aircraft carriers we have. It's going to be decided by how many of our people are trained and educated to compete with the kids who are now being trained and educated in China, India, Russia, and other countries.
In 2013, we had nearly 12 million unemployed college graduates. So that was close to 8% of our graduates were unemployed. Adding to that, you also pointed out that we have our underemployed graduates, such as our teachers. This it cripples millions with an ever increasing student loan debt. What do we do about our unemployed, and I'm going to add to that, underemployed graduates? Because teachers, I would say, are underemployed as far as not really getting paid what they're worth.
Right. Well, we don't have any system in this country for really coordinating our occupational needs, our job needs, with our educational programming. Every once in a while, you'll see an attempt, especially with vocational schools or community colleges, to try to articulate what a particular employer wants, and then to relate that to their educational program, so that the student taking that program knows there's a job waiting for them when they graduate that utilizes those skills or that knowledge. But that's the exception, that's not the rule. So our curriculum is in no way coordinated with our occupational and job needs. Now, I'm not suggesting that the only purpose for education is a job. I mean, education needs to go beyond that. We need to educate lifelong learners, people who don't learn how to perform a skill that's gone in 5 years or 10 years because of the rapid change in our economy. We need to have self-learners who know how to learn and understand, what the requirements are for being adaptive in the workplace, and especially with the new automation that we know is going to displace lots of workers who are now doing jobs. So nobody's ever done this, not just in this country, but any other country. Nobody's ever figured out exactly how you get industries and corporations to predict with any certainty out 5 or 10 years what their employment needs will be, and then relate that back to the schools and the training programs and the education programs in colleges and high schools and maybe even middle schools. And some of the fault lies in corporations and some of the fault lies with schools. I don't think there's an easy answer for that other than perhaps to create these lifelong learners who are very adaptive, and then to have industry take on more of the responsibility for retraining and uptraining their workers so that they can adapt to the changing places and the changing need in the workplace. The distance, the time between high school and working in a 20 or 5 or 30 year career is too great for the schools to be able to train students for those specific skills. So it's going to have to be creating adaptive, resilient learners, and then asking the private sector to help in the training and retraining and adapting those workers over time.
Are there some ways that you could think of that we could make our colleges more beneficial, and first to American students, and additionally to foreign students whom we often don't employ after training them? And I'm going to add something to this just because it's an interesting point. Those we do offer employment to that are foreign, they're often forced to choose between either returning to their family or working here and just sending money to their family. So what can we do to incentivize good skilled labor from the foreign arena, and how can we be more beneficial to our American students so they're not just leaving? And you already kind of answered this partially, but if you have any other ideas besides, hey, how about the industry start taking on some of the education, because they're going to be in this this particular field where they're going to need that. What are some ways that the colleges could be more beneficial beyond what you've already stated?
Well, community colleges are doing a better job of that than our four-year liberal arts institutions. I live in South Carolina, and Boeing moved a massive manufacturing plant down to the Charleston area to build the Dreamliner and some other big aircraft. And it's a huge complex. It's hundreds of acres. And it took them, 4 or 5 years to build the facility. But during that period of time, they entered into a contractual agreement with the community colleges in the state to train workers for that facility. And so they brought in people, they paid their tuition, Boeing did, and they guaranteed them a job if they graduated from these high-skill specific programs that they had paid for and put in place. So you can imagine they were all heavily enrolled in, fully enrolled in, and those students came in, got the training, and moved into those Boeing high-paying jobs. So that's one model. When industry knows what its needs are going to be and there's enough lead time to have an articulated agreement with a college or university or a community college to train students for those specific needs. The other problem you touched on, Lloyd, is a real serious one that a lot of Americans are not aware of, and that is we have this international competition for the best and brightest educated and trained population. Unfortunately, we're handicapping ourselves because we're attracting, in some cases, rewarding foreign students to come to our universities from other countries. And we still have many of the greatest universities in the planet in this country, and other countries recognize that, research universities especially. So some of the best and brightest students from those countries come to these universities, and we train them. We give them this incredible knowledge and set of skills. And then we force them, as you just pointed out, to go back home, even if they don't want to, even if they've fallen in love with America and they want to stay here and contribute to this country, and they want to bring their family or their husband or wife or whatever the case may be, or children, to this country and to be a contributor. We force them to take our training, our skills from our universities back to their countries so that their country can compete with our country. It's insane. It's ridiculous. If they're good enough to be invited here to our best universities, they should be good enough to be invited to stay here after graduation.
You've been listening to an interview with Jim Rex, the national chair of the Alliance Party. We will return after a short break.
The two-party system that we've got is broken.
The choices are awful. All we see is lies, cheating, deceit.
You could say it about both parties. Neither one really stands for anything except acquiring and exercising power.
The idea was to give the power to the people, or the people who've given the power away. And that's where the system broke.
Government and our political system was designed to be malleable, you know, not rigid, not ossified, not always gridlocked.
Absolute power does corrupt, absolutely, and that's why the founders set the system up to avoid having concentrated power in the executive and in the national branch.
The founding documents are the best, it's the best government so far that we've come up with. We're just not doing it.
You know, it's tribalism, basically. If you're not in my tribe, then you're a bad person. You could say the sky is blue, and I'm going to say, no, it's green.
I think it's right out of a 1930s era playbook where if you can divide people, make them feel like something's being taken from them, probably pays well for them to make sure that everybody's divided, because in essence, it keeps them in office, it keeps them in power, it keeps them employed.
The amount of money that's involved in politics, it is crazy.
And Obama's a smart guy, but not even he could, he wasn't going to do it either. And I was like, okay, that's it. If he can't do it, it's not going to happen. Because that's when I knew that the lobbyists and the corporate interests, the outside private interests that really have a hand in making sure that our political system doesn't work, I knew that they had won. And I said, okay, third party is the way to go.
What I think we're trying to do here is to make systemic change. Yeah, we need the right people, but there's not any one person, any one charismatic personality that's going to bring about the change that we so desperately need in this country.
Our biggest goals are election reform.
Knock down those barriers that have been built in the ballot access game by the state governments.
Fixing the dark money.
Getting good health care out there.
We need more women. We need more minorities. We need more occupations and backgrounds.
We don't have set paradigms and beliefs. We just want to solve problems. So we're open books. We're data sensitive. We want data. We want to solve solutions that help the most people.
Let's forget about where we disagree. Let's start with where do we agree.
Let facts be facts and let truth be truth and afford people the opportunity to go and find the information they need.
We require term limits of all of our candidates.
Now, if you have more choices and competition, just like any free market enterprise, competition is going to give you a better product.
Focus on innovation and really learning on a local level.
Free press and educating people in an unbiased way.
Protecting and controlling the deficit.
With respect and courtesy.
Honesty through transparency.
Openness and transparency.
Transparency. I think that's incredibly important in a number of areas, but especially in finances, so that voters can connect the dots.
We want to leave this place in a better condition than we left it for the next generations, pure and simple. Not just my children, all our American kids.
We need to educate every single individual in this country, so every individual has tools they need to succeed in life.
Ultimately, that's what we're doing this for, what we can help the American people be. Not what we say they can be, but what they want to be, and we'll get our party to that point.
We're supposed to help each other rise up, enlighten each other, and start by being civil and respecting other people's opinions.
There's nobody left. We have to do it.
There's right and there's wrong. Nobody owns it. You know, JFK, I believe, was quoted as saying something to the effect of, we don't need to look for the Republican answer or the Democratic answer. We need to look for the correct answer. And that's the types of conversations we're not having. As a people, are we doing what we should be doing?
We're back. We're listening to an interview between our moderator, M. Lloyd Johnson, and Jim Rex, the national chair of the Alliance Party. Let's continue the discussion, starting out with the question as to whether or not a third political party becomes a spoiler for the other two.
Now, here's an argument that is constantly being thrown at us. The argument is thrown at us, don't voters have to choose between the lesser of two evils? And as a rebuttal to that, have there been alternative political parties that have even affected the national election or state election?
There's been a few. It depends on a specific race and, you know, the characteristics of that race. You know, sometimes you have no incumbent in a district. Person died in office or retired. The advantage of the incumbency is cannot be overstated. Over 90% of incumbents are returned to office every election cycle across this country. That's true local, state, and federal, which is one reason we need to get rid of career politicians, because once they get in, you can't get them out. Theoretically, as an abstraction, you can vote them out, but in reality, it very seldom happens. So, you know, we have to deal with that. Give me the example of that question one more time, Lloyd, so I focus directly on what you asked.
Oh, okay. I'll use the national election as an example. I wasn't of voting age at the time, but I know Ross Perot, mm-hmm. he had arguably a small impact to a non-impact to a huge impact, where he got a significant share of the vote, but he was accused of being a spoiler, and that got in the way of the lesser of the two evils getting elected in a lot of people's minds. So I'm just wondering about this whole, how do you address this argument of, well, if you're an alternative party, you're a third party, you're coming in and you're spoiling the race when it's so critical that people choose between the lesser of two evils?
Well, first of all, and I say this partly tongue in cheek, how can you spoil something that's already rotten? And we have a system that's rotten. So, you know, how do you spoil it? Ross Perot is an interesting example of someone who did get into high digits, I think, close to 20%, if I remember correctly. But he was also a multimillionaire, so he had a lot of money. And also he was allowed on the debate stage, the national debate stage, with the presidential candidates from the Republican and Democratic Party. So he got national exposure. And even back then, there were a lot of people frustrated with the two-party system and frustrated with being told over and over again they had to pick the lesser of two evils, not vote for somebody, but vote against somebody. So he started to get traction. The two parties closed ranks right after the Ross Perot phenomenon and set up a system that is so rigged that it's almost impossible for a third party candidate now to get on the national presidential debate stage. And you haven't seen a candidate since Ross Perot be able to do that. The Republicans and Democrats have a committee that makes a decision about who we will get to see for next November's presidential debates. And unless a third candidate has raised a huge amount of money and gotten a certain level of support in the national polls, which is almost impossible, even with a lot of money, because if you don't get publicity, you can't go up in the polls. And if you don't go up in the polls, you can't get publicity. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So they have effectively ensured that no third-party candidate will ever stand alongside the Republican and Democratic candidates again because Ross Perot scared them. What I think we're trying to do with the Alliance Party is to tell the American voter, most of whom, the vast majority of whom are now saying they believe we should have a third party in America, almost two-thirds now are saying that. There are now more people who call themselves independents and not affiliated than there are people who call themselves Republicans or Democrats. And yet those people have no viable choice when they go to the polls in almost every race. So the ground is shifting beneath our feet in terms of what the American people are increasingly saying they're dissatisfied with. What I think it's hard for us to see, all of us, is what the alternative looks like to the system we no longer believe in and trust. And that's just human nature. I mean, we were all born into this two-party system. Our parents were born into it, and our grandparents were born into it. We've, as Americans, become accustomed to these two choices, even though we're the only modern democracy left on the planet that only gives its voters two viable alternatives. And I can't think of anything else in our lives where we would settle for having only two choices. But we've been conditioned to our common life experiences to think this is the way it has to be, even though we're unhappy with the outcomes. So what the Alliance Party is trying to do is to say there is another approach that can make things better for the average citizen in this country, not just the powerful, the rich, and the affluent, but for the average American, the vast majority of Americans. And it's obviously not the system we have now, because you can look around you and see the problems that are not being addressed and the worsening of those problems. So voting for an independent or voting for a third party candidate is not a wasted vote. It's a vote that actually matters. It registers. Most of our districts are gerrymandered. And I think most people are beginning to know what that word means and why it's a word that does injustice to our democracy, where our politicians are choosing our voters instead of our voters choosing our politicians. And because they're gerrymandered, in most cases, the outcome of the election is already predetermined. The winner is going to be a Republican, or depending on the district, the winner is going to be a Democrat. The only real question is which Republican or which Democrat. If it's an incumbent, that's who it's going to be over 90% of the time. If it's an open race, it's going to be the Democrat or the Republican, depending on how the district's been gerrymandered. So really, your vote doesn't matter much. You're dumping it into a bucket of red or a bucket of blue with the outcome already predetermined. So if you want your vote to matter, to be noticed, to send a message, stop voting for just R's and D's. And for God's sake, please stop voting straight party tickets. That is the worst thing you can do for the democracy, where you vote for people just because of the letter next to their name, not for their qualifications.
So moving on from, because of the gerrymandering issue, which is, I think nobody would argue except a Republican or Democrat candidate, that's a major issue. How do you expect to go from seeing that percentage of votes affecting or challenging the gerrymandered districts to winning Congress seats, winning state elections, winning local elections? And in addition to that, how much electoral reform do we need to do? What areas are we just missing that need to be corrected? How are we going to start growing?
Yeah. Well, it's never been done before in this country. So it's challenging. There's a concept called the tipping point, where things seem like they're just barely moving in a certain direction. And then all of a sudden there's a certain critical mass and it flips. It happens. That happened with gay rights in this country over the last 15, 20 years. President Obama did a total reversal on his position on gay marriage because the country changed during his tenure as president. So these major shifts happen, and they happen usually more quickly than people think they will, because it looks like it's a slow, gradual shift, when in fact it reaches that point where it happens rapidly. I think the same thing is going to happen with our political system because of the level of dissatisfaction. I can't think of any other area. I mean, over 90% of Americans are dissatisfied with the United States Congress. And the other 10%, I don't know where their head is. They must all be relatives of the congressman or lobbyist. So almost every American is dissatisfied with our outcomes. That cannot continue. There's going to be some type of change. And history tells us that when things get bad enough, the changes either happen in the streets or they happen in the halls of Congress. And we have a system which supposedly provides the opportunity for it to happen the latter way, not the former way. So, you know, the inequalities that we have in this country, the problems that are not getting solved, are going to demand that we make some major changes. The two parties are going to do what they've always done. They're going to protect the status quo. They're going to protect their privilege and their power at all costs. And so we've got to figure out strategically as an alliance party how we can show Americans that we can provide them a different alternative, not just in terms of what we say, but in terms of what we do. And our candidates, for example, are required to abide by term limits. We enforce them. They cannot serve in elective legislative offices for any more than a combination of 12 years. And it's 12 years because of some offices requiring 2-year, some 4-year, and some 6-year terms. So they can mix those offices, but no more than a total of 12 years. That's really important because once they stay in for long periods of time, as most of them now do for 20, 30 or more years, they become owned by the special interests and they become obedient to the party ideology that caters to those special interests. And so term limits is a game changer. We also require transparency at a level that no other party has ever required. For example, any candidate running for state or federal office, legislative office, has to provide publicly their tax returns from the previous 3 years. That is a level of transparency that no party has ever demanded of their candidates. We also require that if elected to office, while in office annually, they have to publicly declare all outside sources of income, both the source and the amount of money that they're receiving. So you can look for the conflicts of interest, which are rampant in our system. It's not magic that over 90% of our elected Congress people go in as not being millionaires and come out as multimillionaires. They don't do that through the salary that they collect in public office. So corruption is rampant. Conflicts of interest are rampant. But even more importantly than that, ineptitude and gridlock is rampant. And our country is not going to thrive, maybe not even survive, if we don't make some significant changes and do them pretty quickly. And that's going to take a voter change of attitude, a voter change of behavior. But we can't expect that if we don't give them something different. And that's what the Alliance Party is offering them beginning in 2020.
Fake news is a term that's become really popular lately, and free speech, of course, as listeners know, is ingrained in the American psyche. Corporate media is accused of being behind the fake news, by and large. We have independent journalists are not heard nearly as much as corporate media, and we have concerns of surveillance and of privacy. How do these issues challenge free speech? And can free speech go too far? Like, is there a hate speech limit?
Well, I'll take the latter part of your question first. Yes, it can go too far. You know, when you're advocating any form of violence, that's too far. So if hate speech is, you know, I don't like somebody, I don't like you because of this, or I don't like you because of that, I think you have the right to say that. It's obnoxious. You may not agree with it, but, you know, that probably falls under freedom of speech. But if you're advocating any form of violence as a on the basis of that hatred or on the basis of some other fear, whatever it is, that's going too far. As far as, you know, the other part of the question, I'm trying to think exactly the examples you gave me, Lloyd.
Well, privacy and surveillance, as far as how do those scare people away from free speech? Independent journalists, how important are they to free speech? And fake news, specifically by the corporate media, even though independent journalists are accused of it as well, how does that wreck people's ability to execute their free speech?
I don't know that I can even give you a succinct answer, but I'll try. You know, your listeners know about the adage, let the buyer beware. I think when it comes to information, whether it comes from the mass media or on social media or from corporate propaganda for advertisements, whatever it may be. It's good. We have to do the let the consumer beware, let the listener beware, let the viewer beware. And believe it or not, this circles back, I think, to education. We are going to have to create a much more sophisticated consumer of education and a more sophisticated consumer of information, someone who can decipher it. And we have so many very sophisticated forms of propaganda. When I was a high school teacher, I used to teach a four-week unit on propaganda techniques to my high school seniors. And I've always believed it should be a part of the curriculum. And just sort of the basics, there's something called the bandwagon approach. And, you know, that's where you say everybody else is doing it. We're the number one product. You know, people show that, you know, 90% of people like Nike, whatever it is. It's called the bandwagon approach. Everybody else is doing it. You need to do it. You need to buy it. You need to vote for this person, whatever that technique is being used for. There's also something called glittering generalities, where you use certain key phrases that people respond positively or negatively to without ever really giving them any specific information. By the way, tonight I've tried not to do that. You know, you get down to nitty-gritty examples and specifics. But many politicians and many corporate propagandists and marketing experts use glittering generalities. They use certain faces, certain people, certain smiles, certain types of people, personalities that say, gee, I want to be like them, therefore I'll buy that product, or I'll believe what they believe, whatever it is that they're peddling. We don't train American consumers to be aware of those techniques that are being used on them. And whether it's politics or whether it's buying products or whether it's believing certain facts are true when no real evidence is given for believing in those facts. And I don't think our national ethic about free speech should be changed. I think it's one of the valuable things we have as a nation. But I think we can do better by educating our consumers of information, and that's probably our best approach.
So to start moving in the right direction, Jim, what are issues that you would say are manufactured by the media? And you just gave some good examples that you might not need to illustrate that much further. But what are issues also that would matter to voters, like gerrymandering, but typically are getting overlooked or just not getting any attention because major media and special interests don't want you to really pay attention to those?
Well, major media is all about eyeballs and advertisement. They want viewers, and their advertisers pay them big bucks for them to have those viewers so they can sell their products or their services. That's the bottom line. It's money. And so the thing that attracts people to media, including social media, are spectacular issues, dramatic negative events, catastrophes. You know, if you can be scared of something, that's a great draw. So rather than talk about specifics like gerrymandering, for example, or term limits, things that are kind of complicated, they talk down to their audience instead and use these glittering generality propaganda techniques to use code words and certain techniques to get their attention. And unfortunately, I mean, that's been going on for, you know, since ancient times. The Colosseum, you know, the Roman emperors pulled people together and let them watch tigers eat people rather than to deal with the problems of government and the other issues that Rome was not dealing with adequately. So we've always had that dilemma. The problem is with technology now and with people being bombarded with these messages. I saw something the other day said the average person receives over 4,000 messages a day through all these different venues that we have now in our lives. And, you know, we're just not equipped to deal with those. That's too much information. It happens too fast. It's too subliminal. It's too superficial. And so, you know, we don't analyze, we don't absorb, and we don't make good judgments and decisions based on that information. I don't know whether we can educate people to do a better job. I'm a big believer in education, as I said a while ago. I think if we got serious about it, we can make our consumers, you know, better equipped to deal with this new reality that we have in the 21st century regarding information and media.
We've been listening to the final episode of M. Lloyd Johnson's interview with Jim Rex, the national chair of the Alliance Party. We hope you've enjoyed this series, and we hope you'll tune in for our next podcast, where we conduct a roundtable interview with some of the founders of the Alliance Party and talk about some of the challenges in establishing a legitimately recognized political party in all states. You may consider subscribing to this podcast so that you don't miss the next show, which is due to be released on November 3rd, 2019. You can subscribe on iTunes, Google, or Spotify. Every week, we will bring you more interesting topics from the Alliance Party. All content for this podcast is copyright the Alliance Party. Views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Alliance Party. This podcast is a production of the Alliance Party, a decades-long movement of fiscally conservative, moderate, accountable, and reasoned independents, former Democrats, former Republicans, and alienated voters who demand that our elected officials work in the spirit of nonpartisanship for all constituents and provide a better future for our country. This podcast was made possible by your donations to the Alliance Party. If you'd like to help sponsor this podcast directly, get in touch with us through our website at theallianceparty.com. If you'd like to join the Alliance Party, visit our website at theallianceparty.com. Drop in, see what we're all about, and get involved. Volunteer your time, make a donation, submit an article or blog, or run for office. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Dan Schaefer, producer of the Alliance Party After Dark, and on behalf of our moderator, M. Lloyd Johnson, and everyone at the Alliance Party, have a wonderful evening, a great week ahead, and we hope you drop in for our next show. Be safe and be aware.